Welcome to the Dust Off Medic Podcast.
Welcome back to the Dust Off Medic Podcast. Today we will be discussing blood component and fresh whole blood use and damage control resuscitation. Today Trevor and I have Colonel Kapp joining us. Colonel Kapp is the Director of Research at the U.S. Army Institute of Surgical Research and an attending physician with Hematology, Oncology, and the Bone Marrow Transplant Department at Brooke Army Medical Center.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Happy to have you.
So, just getting started here, what is damage control resuscitation and why is it important to flight medics?
Damage control resuscitation in the modern era really grew out from a concept called damage control surgery. There had been relatively little investment in research in trauma after the Vietnam War, from between the Vietnam War and the epidemic of drug-related violence that occurred beginning in the 1980s and into the 1990s in the United States. And, you know, during that period, we saw a renewed interest in treating penetrating trauma because we saw a lot more of it on America's streets. And a former Navy surgeon then at the University of Pennsylvania, Bill Schwab, was working with one of his then fellows, Mike Rotondo, and they were treating a lot of these gunshot wound patients in Philadelphia. And they realized that if you took this sort of fix it all in one go kind of approach and kept the patient in the operating room really a long time to fix multiple injuries, you know, that inflicted a huge stress on the patient. And people and the patients didn't do well. And so they took a staged approach to treating these patients. They called it damage control surgery. And the idea was patch the holes that are causing the greatest threat to life in the moment, get the patient back in the ICU and stabilize them, and then bring them back for staged repair of other anatomic injuries. And this was sort of born out of the Navy concept of damage control on a ship, right? You patch the big holes in the ship and you put out the fires so that the ship doesn't sink or explode. Because if that happens, it's game over. So this was damage control surgery. And they, you know, at the time they were still doing this with a lot of use of crystalloids for volume maintenance and resuscitation. And in that era, there was an epidemic of a new disease entity called acute abdominal compartment syndrome, or just abdominal compartment syndrome, where because they were using very high volumes of crystalloid, patients would just swell up. And, you know, if you had a laparotomy, you'd have edematous bowel, really preventing closure of the abdomen. And patients, and, you know, they realized that this was suboptimal and that more work needed to be done on resuscitation. That's about where things kind of left off until a military surgeon named John Holcomb found himself in Mogadishu in 1993, right before the famous battle memorialized in the film Black Hawk Down. One of their soldiers suffered a serious shark bite on the beach right before the battle. And they used pretty much all the red cell concentrates they had on that patient, used a lot of crystalloid, and pretty much went into the subsequent fighting with very little in the way of stored blood products for resuscitation. And so they had to depend on a walking blood bank to collect fresh whole blood from donors to actually resuscitate their combat trauma patients. Lo and behold, that experience was very formative for Dr. Holcomb because he saw that he could resuscitate patients effectively with much less total volume, and that fresh whole blood worked really well. So I would say that planted the seed for a military kind of reincarnation of the concept of a blood-based resuscitation to complement this approach of damage control surgery. So then fast forward a couple more years and you find ourselves in Iraq and Afghanistan. And Dr. Holcomb, again, with other colleagues like Phil Spinella and Jeremy Perkins and others, observed that the more they, we'll say, approximated whole blood in the use of either component therapy, red cells, plasma, platelets, et cetera, or gave whole blood itself, the better the patients did with less total volume of resuscitation. And the earlier they did that, the better the patient did. So they developed this model that was kind of like, the completing this evolution of the care of the traumatized patient that Bill Schwab and others started with damage control surgery by coupling onto it damage control resuscitation. The idea being, again, return the body to a physiologic state that is compatible not only with life, but with restoration of organ function. And if you've lost blood, then you need to give blood back is sort of a very simplified, but pretty much accurate understanding of the problem. Now, I would say that this approach of damage control resuscitation and why it's relevant to flight medics underwent a little bit more evolution over the last, 10 years, for two reasons. One is through interaction with some of our NATO partners, particularly our colleagues in Norway, Geir Strandenes from the Norwegian Naval Special Operations Forces and others, through the THOR network. THOR is the Trauma Hemostasis and Oxygenation Research Network, bringing together experts from around the world to talk about optimized strategies for taking care of combat casualties. And then our experience in Afghanistan, where we face challenges on evacuation times. And to sum up, about 10 years of research and discussion and publications, what we found was that taking damage control resuscitation, which is really trying to reestablish homeostasis by giving all the functionality of the lost blood of the patient back to the patient, the best way to do that was to do it as soon as possible after injury, and in fact, in the field. And, point of injury would be best, but if that's not feasible, really, the flight medic is the tip of the spear on this. And so Stacy Shackelford and colleagues decided to examine our experience with this in Afghanistan and published a very important paper in JAMA in which they showed that compared to matched controls, patients, severely injured soldiers who received blood transfusion, especially within the first 30 to 40 minutes post-injury or within 15 minutes of medevac arrival, derived a substantial survival benefit. Interestingly, if transfusion was delayed beyond that time window, they really didn't derive much benefit. And I think the way to understand why that is, if you think back to your first interaction with medical training, I mean, what did you learn? You probably learned CPR, right? BLS is kind of the gateway that we all pass through. But what do they tell you in BLS? They tell you, hey, heart stopped. You got to get on that and start pumping again immediately. Don't wait. Yeah, tell somebody to call 911, but get on there and start circulating the blood. Because if you don't do that, the brain, the heart die within minutes, right? Well, in the case of hemorrhagic shock, what's happening is the heart's fine, generally, unless you're really unlucky. There's just no blood to pump. So you can do all the CPR you like. If there's no blood to pump, you're wasting your time. That patient's just going to die. So what you need to do is put blood back in. That's way more important than getting an airway, than putting on a ventilator, bagging him and whatever. I mean, all that is irrelevant if there's no blood in the system. It's completely irrelevant and counterproductive. The most important thing to do is to stop the bleeding and put the blood back in. And so that's the way we kind of, that's where we evolved to in the current state. And I would say that the highest level of care, this art has been honed to a very fine edge, it's probably in the special operations community, and in particular in the 75th Ranger Regiment, where they drill this concept of tactical, or if you another way to put it is remote damage control resuscitation, remote from the hospital. So bringing it to the tactical environment, bringing the hospital, if you will, to the patient, or at least the critical resuscitative care that you would receive in a trauma bay comes to the patient very close to the point of injury. So ironically, all this is coming about 100 years after we first tried doing this in World War I, and physicians then in 1918 basically figured out that patients were bleeding to death and the best thing to do is put blood back in and do surgery as soon as possible. So they put surgical facilities as close as they could to the front lines, and they had blood, what we would call maybe blood support detachments, very close to the front lines, and they had guys in trenches with blood, and they administered it in the trenches as they carried them back to the surgical facility and did their best to take care of them. So, you know, what's old is new, but we're maybe a little bit better at it with different, you know, better blood products, maybe safer blood products, and more abundant blood products for sure. But that is really the history and current practice, state of the art of damage control resuscitation.
I think some big points that you hit on was what we're trying to do as early as possible is get the body back to homeostasis. It just went through a lot of trauma, going into shock, and we want to give this patient the best setup to survive through surgery and make it through those more definitive treatments. And I really like how you mentioned if they lost blood, give blood. It's as simple as that sometimes.
I really like the idea that you were talking about blood support attachments back in World War I. And you think about it, what we're kind of doing now is almost a modern equivalent by Rotary. We're bringing these blood products and these resuscitative tools directly to the patient.
Right. You know, I think some of the refinements that we've added to this are incorporation of various adjuncts that have proven in large randomized trials to be useful. So one of those, as you might guess, is tranexamic acid. You know, between CRASH 2, CRASH 3, woman, and various other trials, I mean, just between those three trials, you've had over 54,000 patients randomized, bleeding patients, randomized to tranexamic acid or placebo. And they've all demonstrated reduction in mortality and especially bleeding mortality within the first 3 hours post-injury administration of tranexamic acid. So we incorporate that into our training for far forward care. Another thing to consider is the importance of calcium. So, you know, maintaining ionized calcium within a normal range is super important for a host of reasons. There's cardiac function, both conduction as well as inotropy. And then there's also vascular tone. And finally, sort of the last thing to go, but important, is coagulation function. Calcium was first identified as important in the coagulation cascade as factor 4. We don't call it that anymore, but it gives you a sense of how critical it is. So what happens when you break cells apart is you release the contents, and the contents contain phosphates and multiple proteins that are negatively charged, and those chelate calcium as well as magnesium, another important cation to consider in critical care. And so even before you think about transfusing a patient or whatever, a severely injured trauma patient is most likely going to be hypocalcemic right off the bat. Then we give them blood products, and all blood products contain citrate as an anticoagulant. Even red blood cell units, some people have the misconception that it's only in plasma or something, but when we collect red cells, we still store them in an anticoagulant solution. So everything's got citrate in it, and that binds more calcium and magnesium. And so you basically start out low, and then you give them blood, and you make them go lower. And it's very hard to catch up, actually, even if you're monitoring and trying to put calcium chloride or calcium gluconate back in. So what we are advocating for in modern, you know, pre-hospital DCR strategies is empiric early calcium, with the understanding that if you're transfusing, like basically if you think I need to transfuse blood to this person, you should be like, you know, with your right hand grabbing the blood and your left hand grabbing the calcium, because it needs to go in early, and you need to keep giving it after, let's say, every 4 units or so. Best is, of course, to monitor ionized calcium, but even empiric therapy is worth doing. Clearly, there's a bit of a safety concern using calcium chloride in a peripheral line, and its safety in IO use is not really well established. That said, I think if you have a patent line and you can flush, you just have to make sure that your line is patent and able to give it. We prefer that people use calcium gluconate with peripheral lines, of course. So TXA and calcium, critical adjuncts to damage control resuscitation, along with blood to give you the functionality of whole blood. So suppose you're in a civilian setting and you don't have whole blood in your hospital system. What do you use? The DOD recently funded the PAMPER trial run out of University of Pittsburgh by Jason Sperry and colleagues, published a couple of years ago in New England Journal of Medicine, which examined the proposition that you could use plasma as a bridge to other blood products. And actually, we found that giving 2 units of plasma prior to the rest of standard of care and whatever that was in the different systems, generally crystalloid, occasionally some red cells, improved survival over standard of care directly. Now, a couple of caveats. One is that plasma improved care in the setting of relatively long pre-hospital times and helicopter transport. So we funded 2 studies, one a multi-center helicopter-based study and one a single study, large urban trauma center ground ambulance study called the Combat Trial run out of University of Colorado, Denver. And what we found in that study is that plasma didn't make any difference. But we had designed the studies to merge the data sets after the fact and then kind of create a larger overall data set and examine the impact of time on the importance of plasma. And it turns out that, as you might guess, the longer your pre-hospital time, the more important it is to start transfusing early and plasma prior to other products like crystalloids improve survival. Now, the patients who did the best got plasma and red cells. So hint, the closer you get to whole blood, and you know, this is what we found in all the studies in Iraq and Afghanistan, which was, you know, the more plasma you transfuse in relation to red cells, the better you do. If you add platelets to that, you do even better. The sooner you do it, the better it goes, etc. And also, 1:1:1 plasma, red cells, platelets is relatively dilute compared to whole blood due to the extra red cell storage solution in the red cell units. And so, you know, you can rapidly kind of dilute out the fibrinogen. So if you add cryo to this mix, you do even better. But now you're talking about a lot of bags. And so this is what led us back to whole blood as kind of, you know, it's so much easier to just spike one bag and give the product that you really need. And a lot of centers are moving in that direction now. And we certainly are in the military, providing much more whole blood forward.
Yeah, it really comes down to logistics and movement of these important products to the field and how to get it there and how to get it to the patient. So we're lucky we are part of a military that has global reach and is able to supply those products.
Yeah, so we are supplying predominantly group O low titer whole blood as stored whole blood. That's the main product we should. Actually, it's the only product. We don't do type-specific whole blood as a stored blood product. The rationale here being that this is really designed to provide the all-in-one emergency blood product generally in an emergency circumstance, so either forward to the hospital or in the trauma bay or trauma resuscitation areas. So there often isn't time for cross-matching. Number one. Number two, the risk of clerical error, particularly in austere settings, mass cal, low light, you know, helicopters, et cetera, is relatively high. So you had two patients, one's A, one's B. Shoot, which one was which? I mean, I've seen this happen in the operating room, let alone in, you know, in a pre-hospital setting. So the risk of giving the wrong red cells is very significant. Because if you think about it, let's say you take A red cells and put them in a B recipient. So regardless almost of what the anti-A titer is in that B recipient, there's enough antibody in there to lyse all of the red cells you give that person. So, you know, you give them whatever, 100 mils just half a unit of A red cells. He's going to lyse the whole thing. And that degree of cell lysis can be catastrophic. You can get immediate cardiovascular collapse, DIC, pigment injury to the kidneys, the whole thing. It's a bad scene. Whereas if you give O whole blood, the red cells will be compatible. All right, so you don't have to worry about the red cells. The plasma may be incompatible, but now you're talking about 200 mils in a unit of whole blood going into the total volume of distribution of the patient. So there's a huge dilutional effect that renders that incompatible plasma relatively insignificant. The other thing is most patients shed A and B antigens into the plasma. In other words, like those antigens get cleaved off of red cells and endothelial cells. And so there's free antigen to bind the antibody and they kind of neutralize each other. So you're really only talking about a small amount of antibody that's going to bind to recipient red cells, and that degree of lysis to the extent that it occurs is trivial. So what we call a minor incompatibility, the plasma incompatibility in O whole blood going into non-O recipients is of much less significance than major incompatibility when you put the wrong red cells in the wrong patient. So it's always safer to just take the O red cells in O whole blood and not worry about it. Now you increase the margin of safety by measuring the anti-A and anti-B titer in the whole blood and picking low titer units. And then you can say, well, not only is the minor incompatibility not a big deal, but we've made it even less of a big deal by choosing units that have low anti-A and anti-B titers. So low titer O is kind of becoming a big deal as a product we ship around the world to forward locations. And we use it in the civilian setting as well. I mean, here in San Antonio, where I live, we have it not only on our helicopter platforms, but also on our ground ambulances. And use it, you know, in the civilian population quite significantly.
Wow, that was a lot of information. That was absolutely wonderful. Going back, I don't even know what we're going to cut out. Claire, you have anything?
I think going back a little bit, talking about one-to-one-to-one component therapy versus whole blood and the pros and cons, I think a big thing to hit on with that is not only is it better, but the convenience. And in the flight environment, we're carrying golden hour containers or golden minute containers, and at most those can hold 3, maybe 4 units of blood or component therapy. So to maximize efficiency of what we're carrying and what we're given, it really is easier and better.
For sure. So there are multiple layers to that that onion we can peel. So one of them is that psychologically, when you say, I got to give this patient blood, people often just reach for red stuff. And that's sort of muscle memory. And the problem is, you know, if you're reaching for the red cells first, you may never make it to the plasma. And the thing that's great about the plasma is that it contains it, you know, everybody's, you know, focuses on the coagulation factors, and those are very important. But they also contain anticoagulants. And those are potentially important as well in terms of returning the system to balance. So it's not just all about giving, you know, a whole bunch of procoagulants. It's about giving a balanced sort of physiologic resuscitation. Plus, you got to give volume to this bleeding patient, right? So you kind of need all of it. And it's easier to do that if it's just all in one bag. Now, there's another thing to consider here, which is if you take a trauma pack of 6, 6, and 1, 6 red cells, 6 plasma, and a unit of apheresis platelets, it's pretty typical. You know, that's got a total volume of just over 4 liters, typically. Maybe like, 4.1 liters or thereabouts. Okay, so 6 plus 6 plus 1 is 13, and that's not counting any cryo. Versus to get the same volume out of whole blood, you only need 8 bags of whole blood. So 13, not a lucky number in any culture. 8, in some cultures, it is a lucky number. I'm going to go with 8, right? So much easier, so much simpler to deliver basically the same thing. There's another issue here, which is pediatric transfusion. So if you take a 30 kilo child, you know, sort of in that 8 to 10 year old range, their total blood volume is going to be in the ballpark of 2 to 2.2 liters. So if you give them a trauma pack's worth of blood to try to give them a balanced resuscitation, you think volume overload might be a problem? It's going to be a problem. Okay. So in pediatrics, the threshold for calling it a massive transfusion is 40 mils per kilo. All right. So in that 30 kilo child, all right, you're looking at 1200 mils, not 4000 whatever mils, right? So my point here is that you have a much easier product to titrate depending on the size of the patient. You're not trying to balance the use of multiple different size bags and all that. You just say, oh, here's this kid, looks about X size. I can kind of mentally scale the blood volume this is like half an adult. If I'm replacing, let's say, half of that kid's blood volume, now I'm going to give him 2 bags of whole blood. That's it. And, you know, or maybe even, you know, if you're not sure how much bleeding has occurred, start with 1 unit and see where it goes, see what the response is, and then titrate from there. So much easier to do. This is one of the reasons why some hospitals prefer using whole blood in pediatric cardiac surgery, because it's titratable. Now, the different components of whole blood, we'll just simplify it by saying plasma, platelets, and red cells, are stored differently as component therapy. And storing them all together presents a logistical advantage. You just need to put them in the refrigerator. You don't have to have like a freezer, a refrigerator, and a room temperature incubator with an agitator in it for the platelets, as we commonly do. However, maybe those storage conditions are not optimal for the product. So this has been one of the critiques of whole blood, that, you know, some of the plasma factors will degrade if they're not stored frozen. The platelets may not circulate as long as you would like if you store them refrigerated. So there's no free lunch. What we have found in studying whole blood quality is that in terms of hemostatic function, it does decline over the course of its shelf life, as one might expect, unless one believes in the Easter Bunny and, you know, there are no trade-offs. However, I would just say that even at the end of normal shelf life or approved shelf life, FDA-approved shelf life, there's still quite a bit more platelet function in a unit of whole blood than there is if you just transfuse red cells and plasma together as components. Not as good as a fresh unit of platelets, no question about it. But that isn't really the option you're talking about there, because how often do you have a fresh unit of platelets on your helicopter? Never, right? So, you know what I mean? Like, it's all about trade-offs. And I think having some platelet function is better than having zero platelet function when you're talking about critical hemorrhage. So, I think that's all I want to say. I mean, we could talk a lot about the different ways in which we've evaluated component therapy versus whole blood and all the different testing that's been done on that.
I think the big thing you were talking about there is really especially applying to pre-hospital, is simplicity is king. And the simplicity of doing 10 mLs a kilo of whole blood for a pediatric patient in order to resuscitate is a lot easier and a lot better for the patient than having to split up, you know, the 300 to 400 mLs in a packed cell and the 200 to 300 in a plasma. And instead, you're really giving them all at the same time. And it just takes a weight off the flight medic's shoulders when you do that.
Exactly. And you know, there's limited space in a helicopter. There's, you know, there's cognitive overload. And so, yeah, simplifying, speeding things up, getting the blood in is really what you want to do. Now, one thing that comes up is this. So do you have to have O neg around to give to women of childbearing or females of childbearing potential? Because it's not just women of childbearing age, but, you know, in the pediatric population as well, these girls may one day go on to desire fertility, and therefore you want to protect them from alloimmunization to the D antigen, especially, which can cause hemolytic disease of the fetus and newborn. So what's the deal with making sure you have O negative versus O positive? The simple fact of the matter is that you're never going to have enough O negative. And so it's basically impossible to ensure a low titer O whole blood, O negative whole blood availability in any setting, pre-hospital or otherwise. And in fact, even if you were doing component therapy, you'd be hard pressed to have O negative wherever you are. So what's to be done to consider this risk for females in this age group, which we'll just basically say is anyone up till about age 50. So the way we've looked at this is to say, first of all, you got to be alive to get pregnant. And if you're bleeding to death, you should get an effective therapy to treat the exsanguination. And if that's O positive whole blood, then so be it. So that's point number one. Therapy should never, ever be delayed in a critically bleeding patient just to try to match on D antigen. Okay, so the second point is that, let's just say your patient is in fact D negative, RhD negative, and you give her 1 to 2 units of whole blood pre-hospital, and it's O positive. What are you going to do about this? So first of all, you know, you want to kind of look at what is the overall risk of becoming alloimmunized, right? I mean, that's the first question, is what is the total risk? So we have calculated this. So the risk of becoming alloimmunized to the D antigen is around 20%, okay, 22% in one study. And the risk of an Rh negative pregnancy, an Rh negative sensitized pregnancy, so woman who's Rh negative, who now is making anti-D antigens and who has a fetus that is Rh positive, and those antibodies are crossing the placenta and causing hemolysis in the fetus, is around 28%. So, and that would cause severe hemolytic disease of the fetus and newborn. So you multiply those risks out, right? It's a 22% risk of it being alloimmunized in the first place, multiplied by a 28% risk. So it's about a combined risk of 6% of having, you know, the worst outcomes of a pregnancy. So, you know, remember that you start with a person that you're considering giving a pre-hospital transfusion to. What are the competing risks here? So I tell you, if you give her this couple of units of OPAS, she's got a 22% risk of developing an antibody. And then if she gets pregnant, that antibody has about a 28% risk of causing severe HDFN. Okay. So overall, 6% risk of having bad outcomes in a pregnancy. Now, by the way, you can treat hemolytic disease of fetus and newborn with intrauterine transfusions. So mortality from this, unlikely in the fetus, okay? But still requiring pretty sophisticated maternal fetal medicine care once the patient, you know, is in a position to have this. So the competing risk is death from exsanguination. In the military population, we've had relatively few female combat traumas as a percentage of the overall, but the average mortality rate is around 16% for combat trauma patients requiring blood transfusion. So 16% dead, 6% bad outcomes in a possible future pregnancy. The answer is give her the OPAS every time. Now, oh, by the way, the other risk that's not in here is what are the odds of the person being RHD negative in the first place? And so it's 15% RHD negative. So actually, with you not knowing what the patient actually has, it's 15% times 22% times 28%. You see what I'm saying? So the odds that this woman in front of you is going to end up with a bad outcome from pregnancy because you gave her OPAS is in the low, low, low single digits. Okay? So save her life and give her the OPAS. Now, you gave her the OPAS. What do you do in the hospital? Do you reverse it with Rogam or Rofilac or Winro, some kind of Rh antibody? Or not? And the answer there is it depends on how much OPAS the patient got. There are various ways that are probably outside the scope of this talk to figure out kind of how much of that original transfusion is still in her, because obviously if she's still bleeding, it may never be an issue because it bled out. But even if the whole unit is still in there, up to one unit of whole blood or red cells concentrate, you can generally safely neutralize with an antibody infusion. Now, the patient is going to lyse those red cells. They'll do it in the spleen and the liver, and so it won't cause that same cardiovascular collapse that it does if they lyse it intravascularly. But, you know, if they have a marginal hemoglobin postoperatively and so forth, they may require yet another red cell transfusion to relieve critical anemia. So, you know, these decisions all require multidisciplinary consultation to figure out what the right course is. If the patients receive more than one unit of OPAS and they're Rh negative, we do not recommend trying to do anything about it. That's where you just accept the risk and move on. Sometimes people talk about red cell exchange and all that, but the problem there is that although red cell exchange is commonly done, for example, for sickle cell patients, you have to do extended phenotyping of the red cells to make sure all the other antigens match. And that takes a while. And for this to work, you got to do it in the first 72 hours after transfusion. And generally the patients have other stuff going on. Like, you know, they're in the hospital for their major trauma and, you know, it's just too complicated to arrange. So more than one unit of OPAS in, we generally say, just forget about it. It is what it is. Low likelihood of this being a problem, but not zero, you know, low single digits. Less, you know, one unit or less in, then we would try to reverse it with an anti-D antibody. I hope that wasn't too much in depth on all this, but this question does come up quite a bit of like, well, what about women of childbearing potential? And you're like, well, sometimes it helps to walk through the math to show people that it's really not worth, it's a consideration, but the more important consideration is staying alive.
And I think that's a great point, also looking towards transfusion reactions, because what we're ultimately doing...
I knew you were going to ask that.
Yeah, it's a good segue into that. Because what we're ultimately looking for when we're giving our patient mass transfusions or even blood products when they've suffered a significant traumatic event where they need resuscitation with blood products, we're kind of weighing between what's going to kill them or what's going to keep them alive enough to deal with this reaction. So I think that's a good segue into what kind of transfusion reactions should people be looking for, where you're getting past the point of minimal percentages of killing the patient?
Yeah, so by far the most common transfusion reactions we see across all transfusions are febrile non-hemolytic transfusion reactions. Also really close in the running are what we'll call anaphylactoid reactions, sort of the hives and itchiness that are really caused by mast cell degranulation, but not full-blown anaphylaxis. So in a patient that you will be treating on a helicopter who's bleeding to death, you are not going to see these reactions, number one. So forget about all of that. What could you see? Well, you could see anaphylaxis, for example, due to something like IgA deficiency, which is not super common, but it is the most common of the genetic causes of major anaphylaxis in blood transfusions. You know, the problem here is that there's kind of nothing you can do about it. So let's just say you had a patient who suffered a traumatic amputation, above the knee amputation, car took the leg off, you put a tourniquet on it, or two. You know they've lost at least a quarter of their blood volume because it was in the leg and it's gone now. And more was on the road, so that's a problem. And you know they're going to need blood, but somebody put a tourniquet on them fast enough that, like, they still have blood pressure. Okay, so your patient's got, like, a blood pressure of, whatever, 80 systolic over, whatever, they're tachycardic. I mean, they're in shock. They're in a shock index over one, meaning all of the criteria sort of for pre-hospital transfusion. And you put your first unit of whole blood in there, or your unit of plasma or red cell, whatever. And all of a sudden the pressure goes to zero. And let's just hypothetically say this is due to, say, IgA deficiency and anaphylaxis, because now you've put IgA in them, and in the extremely unlikely event that they mount an anaphylactic reaction, there it is, it happened to you. Now, what's your best move? Well, you got a problem, don't you? Because they start off with hemorrhagic shock, and now they got anaphylactic shock. So they got, like, shock squared. So if you read the transfusion medicine textbooks, they will say, stop the transfusion, you know, send it to the lab for a workup to make sure it's not infected and they got the right blood type and all that other stuff, and start them on crystalloids to flush out the kidneys in case there's any hemolysis. You don't want a pigment injury. And, you know, if they're having other kinds of reactions, give them, like, you know, antihistamines, H2 blockers, maybe some steroids. And if they really drop their pressure, give them some epi. Okay. Great idea. Problem is, they started out with hemorrhagic shock. They still need blood. You know, stopping all of that and saying, all right, well, now I'm going to give this person like 10 units of, or 10 liters of saline to treat their anaphylactic reaction, is ignoring the fact that, like, they lost half their blood volume. So that's the problem. You still need to give them blood. So what's the answer here? I think the answer is you're just going to give them more blood. You know, you can give them a hit of epi if you like. That's probably not wrong. I don't know that I would waste any time with Tylenol, Benadryl, and any of this other stuff. If you were in a prolonged field type setting and you had a bunch of kit, you know, could you give them some Dex? You could. Dexamethasone. But honestly, for the most part, you don't have time for any of this. The best you can do is probably keep going with the blood transfusion, give them more blood. If you had more units of blood, you could switch units and give them a different unit of blood. But in all likelihood, by the time you figure out, like, that you've ruled out ongoing bleeding as the cause for the pressure dropping, you've probably given most of the blood, because my guess is you're squeezing this in, right? You're not infusing this unit over 4 hours on the ward here, right? you know, you put in an IO or, you know, a big peripheral and you're squeezing the bag in to try to get the blood pressure from crashing and it crashes on you anyway, you know, your first move is not to think of IgA deficiency. Your first move is to take a look at that tourniquet and make sure it's still on, right? Or look for other sites of bleeding that maybe you missed on your primary survey. So, I mean, I think that that's the reality is that this all happens so fast, you will not recognize it. Now, what else could happen? Could you have some kind of incompatibility reaction where you have major hemolysis? Yeah, I mean, I guess it could happen. You could have a mislabeled blood unit. Unlikely, but yeah, you know, who knows? Okay, you're not giving them O for some reason. You're giving them type specific, and you give them the wrong unit, or walking blood bank. Somebody did a blood type and got it wrong, or what have you. Or frankly, they just have, you know, an anti, whatever other antigen, high titer antibody from prior transfusions or pregnancy, and they lyse the cells from that. Is that going to happen? Probably not, but it could. So what do you do? Same thing. Patient still needs massive resuscitation with blood. And so you still have shock squared. And you really don't have a choice. So basically what I'm telling you is you probably don't need to worry about transfusion reactions as a major cause of mortality or morbidity in the setting of resuscitating patients for hemorrhagic shock. Now, you know, if the patient's awake and talking to you and you are going to infuse them with a unit of blood over a 2-hour helicopter ride for whatever reason, and they're not in hemorrhagic shock and you're giving them blood because whatever somebody told you to, whatever the circumstances are, you know, now it's different. Like these rules, the textbooks are written for the ward setting where, you know, you infuse the first, I don't know, 100 mils of blood over, you know, or 10 mils of blood over 15 minutes just to see, make sure everything's fine, checking vitals every 2 minutes and all this kind of stuff. You are not doing this in the back of a helicopter, right? Because if you wait to do it that way, the patient's going to be long dead before there's any chance of a transfusion reaction. So all of those rules kind of go out the window. I mean, the main thing is start out with a product that you know is going to be compatible with the vast majority of patients, something like low titer O, or you're going to give them O red cells with either AB or A plasma. Yes, by the way, you can give A plasma to anybody and consider it essentially a universal plasma. We can get into that in a second. But you're going to give them universal, quote-unquote, product. And guess what? If they happen to have hemorrhagic shock and a catastrophic transfusion reaction at the same time, well, that's just really bad luck. I don't know what else to tell you. You know, there's nothing else you can do about that. You just keep going. Give them all the blood you got. Give them some epi. Say a prayer.
I'm totally stealing that shock squared. Next time I have a patient go sideways, I'm just looking at my partner and be like, hey, man, shock squared.
Right. <don't> But I mean, you know, that's just what it is. It's like, it's worse than anything else. But, you know, honestly, all of this requires some sort of like, you know, I mean, the immunologic function component's got to be there, right? I mean, antibodies circulate, they're passive, I get that. But really, if you are appropriately selecting your patients, okay, so in San Antonio, I mean, you don't have to use this rule, but in San Antonio, we teach our flight medics and our ground medics who carry blood to look at the shock index. So if the heart rate, so we look at a shock index greater than 1, that's a conservative approach. Some people will say 0.9, but if we have a mechanism of injury or illness, because by the way, we give blood to people who have GI bleeds and postpartum hemorrhage and whatnot in the field as well, you know, but if you have like some kind of mechanism of injury or illness consistent with hemorrhage and your shock index is greater than 1, you know, you're probably good to go to, you know, get ready for a blood transfusion in that patient. And shock index is easy, right? Heart rate greater than blood pressure, systolic blood pressure. Simple. Anybody can. I mean, you got to be able to get a blood pressure. Of course, if you can't get a blood pressure and you're in that situation and they have any heart rate, you're good. You know, it's pretty simple. But these patients are very unlikely to mount a transfusion reaction that you are going to be able to detect or do anything about meaningfully. So I just don't think it's a major consideration.
Yeah, it's amazing how frequently we have guests on the show and how frequently the shock index comes up as consistently a great way to get a general feeling of like badness of what's going on. If you see that heart rate and that's greater than blood pressure, that's a bad sign, and that should be an immediate red flag.
In the right context, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's blood all over the place and the shock index is up. Okay. You know, yeah, you got a problem here, because that's like not normal that happens. I mean, you know, if you can get a lactate and the lactate is greater than 2.5, and, you know, by the way, the iStat's also telling you that the hematocrit is 7, like, fine, then you feel even better. But I don't think you need all of that to make a reasonably experienced person can look at the situation and go, yep, that's all I need to know.
And that kind of segues into this question. What are kind of the physiologic parameters we look at and the injury patterns to look for and why? We've kind of touched on a few of them, but I know looking back a few years ago when we were looking at studies, we were looking at a heart rate greater than 120 and a systolic less than 90. What's changed?
These are really, really interesting questions. Okay, let me get to the injury pattern work first, and then we'll get to the physiologic monitoring. So from an injury pattern standpoint, if you're talking about combat trauma, you know, there's that famous 2012 paper by Brian Eastridge and colleagues that had like a huge autopsy study. It was over 1,000 autopsies, 1,500 maybe, something like that, where they kind of said, all right, you know, 75% of patients die pre-hospital, so they're KIA. Of the ones who are KIA, die pre-hospital, 75% have definitely non-survivable injuries, as in devastating tissue destruction, you know, high-velocity gunshot wound to the head, you know, dismemberment, whatever. Like, anybody can tell that person is not going to survive. Well, you know, but a quarter of these patients that die pre-hospital have injuries that theoretically could be fixed, right? For example, gunshot wound to the lower abdomen hits an iliac. Can you fix an iliac artery? Yeah, you can. So they coded those as potentially survivable. Now, this work has recently been updated by Ed Mazikowski and company from the Armed Services Medical Examiner's Office. And they said, you know, really? Can you fix an iliac artery transection for real? I mean, is that really survivable? So they did this really interesting analysis. This is Mazikowski and Coatwell just came out, and they've got another paper that's like in press as well. So a whole series of papers on this. But the short story is that they looked at the DoD trauma registry, and they tried to match autopsy cases with various injury patterns with people who were entered into the DODTR. And so to review, the only way to get into the DODTR is to survive to admission to a Role 3 combat support hospital. So if you died before you got to the Role 3, then you didn't get put in the DODTR. And it turns out that just to sort of give you the overall, you know, bottom line up front, if you had a major arterial injury in the trunk, you ended up on the autopsy table, not in the DODTR. They were like very few matching cases. So, you know, if somebody puts a knife in your abdomen in the trauma bay, and the vascular surgeon is standing right there, can they repair that arterial injury to your iliac? Maybe. But in real life, you die every time. So that's kind of sobering. But it's interesting also, because what it does is when you start pruning these, yeah, theoretically, if the vascular surgeon's standing right there kind of stuff,
and you remove all of that to like, no, for real, like, what are you actually going to save here? The number of potentially preventable deaths on the battlefield goes way down. Now, where are the opportunities for improvement anyhow? Where, like, yeah, there are probably things we could have done differently and better and avoided a few of those autopsies. Yeah, it all comes back to hemorrhage control, early blood transfusion, and early transfer to a surgical facility. So the message of how do you prevent people from dying early is still valid. Stop the bleeding, give blood, get them to surgery. Very simple. But I guess we got a little bit of reassurance that we weren't leaving a quarter of the KIAs kind of out there. It wasn't a system failure that led to their deaths. It was a, you know, if you take an AK-47 round through the aorta, that's a lethal injury. You know, just no way around it. That's the reality. So, I say that just to tell you, that, you know, there's been some evolution in our understanding of what is and is not survivable. So venous injuries, lacerations to solid organs like liver, spleen, kidneys, you know, where there's potentially some tamponade kind of effect going on, where, you know, I mean, you still obviously have a high risk of mortality, but these are things where we really see the greatest benefit from our far forward damage control resuscitation. Traumatic amputations or other major extremity injuries that are amenable to compression through tourniquets and or pressure dressings. Also, clearly an injury pattern that is more... you know, that's amenable to intervention. So I think it's important to recognize that there's certain things that are more treatable than others. Transaxial gunshot wounds, like the classic, you know, hey, come over here, and you know, a gunshot goes below the axilla, you know, and out the other side, going through essentially the mediastinum and all the great vessels and all that. Yeah, that's not survivable, really. You know, those patients don't do well. So, you know, and it's not surprising necessarily when you think about the anatomy, but this is what the latest research shows us. Now, regarding physiology, you bring up a great point, which is we've actually known since World War II that adequacy of resuscitation really does matter. I mean, the closer to baseline physiology you can get the patient, the more likely they are to survive. In World War II, we found that patients showing up at surgical facilities with a blood pressure less than 80 had astronomically high mortality, which is one of the places where the 80 systolic kind of came from. But when you really look at, when you sort of parse the data a little bit more, you find that mortality kind of really starts to take off below a blood pressure of about 100 systolic. And for TBI patients, it's anything below 110. I mean, you know, the curve is not linear. It's kind of more got an exponential shape. So, you know, the idea that you can keep somebody who's got a severe brain injury functional and even alive with a systolic blood pressure of 80 is just not really founded in reality. So we've revised the damage control resuscitation clinical practice guidelines with this in mind. And we're now, you know, acknowledging all this and saying really what you want to do is trying to get them to a blood pressure, a systolic blood pressure of about 100, with a kind of buffer range around it of 90 to 110, and shoot for 110 or higher if there's a traumatic brain injury. Another reason for doing this is, so let alone, you know, leaving alone the difficulty of actually targeting a specific blood pressure in the pre-hospital setting, where there's so much noise going on, just getting a blood pressure period can be quite difficult, and maybe even pointless in some cases. Certainly in a sort of care under fire kind of scenario, we're not worried about that there. Leaving all that aside, people have tried to do randomized trials targeting a blood pressure in the operating room. And those trials have been stopped for futility. The most notable of these was by Rick Dutton and colleagues about a decade or so ago. So even under the most controlled scenario, it's just very hard to consistently keep a patient in the same, you know, within a tight blood pressure band. So recognizing the futility of trying, recognizing the, you know, almost impossibility of doing this in the pre-hospital setting. And also recognizing that, you know, closer to normal is actually better. We're saying kind of shoot for about 100. And if you go over that a bit, that's okay too. Is really the approach that we're advocating now. A couple of things that people bring up from time to time is, hey, what about popping the clot? Well, not a lot of great data for that. I mean, it is certainly true that you will not bleed if your blood pressure is extremely low. All bleeding stops eventually, they joke, right? Nevertheless, the metabolic consequences of hypoperfusion are really pretty spectacular and bad. And so, you know, driving blood pressure is super physiologic is not desirable. But keeping them around 100 is really not a problem from the hemostasis standpoint. Some of the animal work that purported to show that, you know, 80 was a good place to keep people to avoid popping the clot, it's a lot more complicated than it looks. Let me just put it that way. And in fact, to get some of these animal models to rebleed, they had to administer vasopressors and so forth. And so it's really not as clearly cut a risk as it has been made out to be. So certainly the lower the blood pressure, the less you bleed. Got it. Lower the blood pressure, the less you perfuse everything. Got it. In terms of these competing risks, you are better off shooting for a blood pressure of around 100 systolic, 110 or greater with a TBI, and not worrying about rebleeding as much.
And we're going to pause here. Join us in 2 weeks for more with Dr. Kapp. In the meantime, check out our Instagram at dustoff.medic.podcast or email us at contact@dustoffmedicpodcast.com. If you have any questions or anything you would like to hear in the future. And thanks again for listening to the Dust Off Medic Podcast.